Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. Glad to be joined today by Texas Politics Project Research Director Josh Blank, and we must begin by celebrating the thrilling victory of the United States soccer team.
You know,
do we not?
No, I mean,
Josh,
of course.
Give us the bullet there.
Yeah.
I watched it, but I, of course,
you know,
just watched it.
One of the rare instances in which you have nothing to say. Look, first of all, I want to say it's great on, you know, going into the 4th of July weekend that, you know, there's something that we can all agree on, which is our love of soccer. And so that's exciting. But, you know, for those of you who are paying light attention, the U.S. beat Bosnia-Herzegovina last night 2-0. It was a thrilling match. The U.S. was the favorite, but Bosnia is a very tough team. Bosnia knocked Italy out of the World Cup. Italy was not even able to participate in this World Cup because Bosnia knocked them out. They knocked out a couple other European teams. So they're a good, very hard team to beat. The U.S. won. There was a red card. They had to fight for it. So next game, Monday night, I know I'll be watching it. I hope you all will too. So there you go. That's the
so
rundown.
The commentators seem to think that red card was kind of a judgment call and maybe a bridge to a little severe. The way it actually looked, I have no context to judge that. It didn't look like anybody did anything on purpose, but I don't know if intent is part of the
judgment. That's been like a long-term thing, the development of soccer. And for a long time, intent was a really big part of it. And then people were like, well, wait a minute, how do we judge intent? And I was like, oh, we have no idea. And so they stopped doing that. And so it kind of just becomes about recklessness and danger. And the problem with that play is that, you know, ultimately it's two guys who are right next to each other, both making a soccer play. And it's clear that there's no intent to hurt the guy. Now, if he had gone in really fast and really hard, he wasn't in control of his body, you could still get a card for that. You could still get a red card for that. But nobody thinks that's what happened there. And so I think, you know, it was a pretty harsh call. There's also protocols for how they're supposed to use the video assistant referee. They didn't really follow those. They're not supposed to start by sending the referee over with a still image of the most gruesome image you can show. You're actually supposed to do it based on the full replay and then go from there. So there are problems with it. It's unfortunate the U.S. lost their most dangerous attacking player and maybe their best player of the tournament so far for the next knockout game. So they're going to be up against it, but they were going to be up against it either way. So, you know, it's part of the tournament.
Well, that is a very well-reasoned response. I was waiting for, yeah, we was robbed, but okay.
Yeah. Nice try. You know, when I get my minute, I'm going to take it.
Minute?
Yep, that's right. You heard me.
We're laughing here in the booth.
You heard me.
All right. So, per last week's podcast, we were going to take this week off, but, you know, partially it's your instigation and, you know, there was a lot going on. I'd been gone for the weekend, but there has been a lot going on, much of which, you know, we have related and recent polling on. So we're sucking it up and deciding to do something this week anyway. Hopefully, if you're out there listening to this, you're listening while en route to somewhere nice, or you're already there with a drink in your hand. And if you had a drink in your hand, I don't know, sometimes it's good to doze off in a chair or something listening to a podcast. Now, as we record this mid-morning on Thursday, July 2nd, the biggest news headlines really are the kind of final tranche of Supreme Court decisions for the 2025-2026 session. And there were three pretty big ones. So what we thought we'd do is hit the three of those really quick and kind of plot out some Texas and some data correlates for that. So let's start with Trump v. Barbara. The court ruled 6-3 to strike down President Trump's executive order that sought to end birthright citizenship for children born in the U.S. to parents who are lawfully or either unlawfully or temporarily present. So basically, again, the general principle of birthright citizenship. The majority affirmed that the 14th Amendment guarantees automatic citizenship to virtually everyone born on U.S. soil. And the 14th Amendment part of that is critical here as we see both President Trump's reaction, some reactions in Congress, you know, in the direction of saying, well, Congress can fix this. Well, it doesn't seem like Congress can fix this based on the reasoning of the majority in the decision. Now, we've asked about birthright citizenship a few times in the UT Texas Politics Project poll, most recently in April, and that we put those items on the poll in anticipation of the court making this decision. I don't think those numbers have moved around a lot over time, some, but not a lot. We can talk about that. But we also added another twist in the most recent iteration in the April poll based on internal discussions that we were having about wording of the question. So let's talk a little bit about the results of that. We, you know, talk at least a little bit about the differences in the wording and what we think is going on there, Josh.
Yeah. So, you know, as you said, we have two questions. And the one that we've asked historically asks about support essentially for repealing the part of the 14th Amendment that guarantees automatic citizenship, as you said, essentially virtually anyone born in the U.S. Now, even just saying that out loud, obviously, that's a little bit complicated, which led to some of our discussions or is, you know, around whether or not there's an easier way we can present this. And then furthermore, whether presenting it in an easier way, you know, provides us with any more clarity about the underlying attitudes. So real quick to this sort of construction that focuses on repealing the 14th Amendment or this part of the 14th Amendment that allows for automatic citizenship, we've asked this at least four times going back to 2011. Now in 2011, a slight majority, 53%, said they supported repealing this, 37% opposed repealing. Jump into today, and those numbers have largely flipped. 37% support repealing this part of the 14th Amendment that allows for automatic citizenship. 48% opposed repealing this part of the 14th Amendment. Now, that's been pretty consistent in the most, you know, sort of recent tranche of data. In 2025 and 2026, we've seen pretty similar numbers like that. Now, as you pointed out, we asked a different kind of question, which in some ways I think is just meant to be easier. I mean, I think in a lot of ways, we just said, you know, do you think anyone born in the U.S. should be granted U.S. citizenship? You know, just full stop, right? And interestingly, though, these numbers do in some ways, you know, there's a little, I'll say this. The first thing you notice is that the share of don't know goes down a little bit because it's an easier question. And what you find overall, interestingly, is 62% of Texans, the majority, say yes, they do think that anyone born in the U.S. should be granted U.S. citizenship. 30% say no, but this obviously hides significant underlying differences in partisanship. 92% of Democrats, they believe in this idea of automatic citizenship. Among independents, it was 47-42, yes, no. And among Republicans, it was 38-50. So that's pretty interesting, I think, overall, which is it sort of, you know, speaks to the fact that birthright citizenship repeal is not really a slam dunk issue within the party, even within the party. And when we looked at some key groups, you know, 55% of white Texans said yes, that everyone basically born in the U.S. should be granted citizenship. 37% said no. 64% of Hispanics said yes. 26% said no. So in a lot of ways, I mean, I don't think that, you know, there's a way that this obviously, we've talked about this a lot, this, you know, brings in the threads of immigration and issues that are really important to the Republican Party. But this kind of change, you know, sounds pretty drastic to most people who kind of understand constitutional design and structure and, you know, history. And the court kind of, you know, it's a kind of affirmed that because four justices said otherwise, right? But
yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, as I was gonna say, but just in general, this is one of those areas where, you know, we talk all the time about how it's sort of hard when you look at these public opinion items to find the limits of Republican support for proposals that would limit or otherwise cut off immigration. And even here, you know, placed in constitutional principles and sort of things that I think a lot of people understand, it turns out, this one's a little bit on the edge, if not kind of far out.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was, you know, it was kind of interesting that, I mean, you emphasize the differences in the response as a, you know, partially as a result of complexity. But I think in some ways, I expected those results to look a little bit, you know, to be a little bit different. In other words, I think the theory of the case that at least was sort of floated when we were talking about this was that changing the Constitution might increase resistance, but that really wasn't the case, right?
I don't think we've seen that. I don't think that changing the Constitution has necessarily or the idea of proposal to change is increased resistance. I think Trump overall has increased resistance. So I think when you look at sort of go back to that first question, sort of the 14th Amendment version of it, to speak of that.
Right, right.
And when you look sort of at the 10-year span from November of 2015, you know, in November of 2015, 66% of Republicans supported repealing that part of the 14th Amendment. In February of 2026, it's 61%, which we would say is about, you know, margin of error kind of stuff. It's about the same range. Was for Democrats in November 2015, only 59% opposed repealing that part of the 14th Amendment. And today it's 85%.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I guess I was thinking about the differences in wording rather than across time.
But. Oh, yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah, no, I can see that too. Well, I don't know.
I'm not saying, without attributing positions to any specific member of the polling team. I mean, I felt like that was a little bit about what was driving that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it didn't really kind of meet that expectation necessarily.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I mean, I think, you know, ultimately what we're finding, and we'll kind of get to this as we talk about some of the other issues here, is, you know, our sense of what is sacred and what is, you know, untouchable and what is, I think, is probably less fixed right now, you know, than what we've seen in times past, right? And I think that's going to come up when we talk about the parties and some other stuff, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. So, all right, so let's move on to the next decision. Now, another decision handed down recently touched on an issue that's been front and center nationally, but particularly in Texas, that is in West Virginia v. BPJ, which is the initials of the defendant who was of the party to the case who was a minor at the time. So just the initials. The person has since become identified, I think, by their own volition. So in that case, in a 6-3 decision, the court sided with West Virginia and Idaho, upholding state laws that ban transgender women and girls from participating on female public school and college sports teams. Now, Texas passed a law, and the Texas was ahead of the beat on this, obviously, but not a party to this case, had passed a law in the 2021 session to this effect. And we have a couple different dimensions here. So when this was still sort of brewing in the legislature after, you know, a series of court challenges, the legislature took this up again in 2023. So we have public opinion about the legal issue at play here.
Right.
And then a little bit of data that's more recent on underlying attitudes. And that first result I was thinking about was from June 2023, right?
Yeah, that's correct. So one of the questions we asked was about support or opposition for requiring athletic participation in both K-12 and higher ed to be based on biological sex. And this was around a couple of questions that we asked sort of around sort of topics and potential restrictions on transgender identity and people and public expression and things like that. And the first thing I'll just say is, you know, sports has been really the main entry point in a lot of ways, because that's where we see the most support for the restrictive policies, just historically. Right. And you see that nationally too. I think it's not just in Texas. It's not a Texas thing, to be honest.
Yeah.
So overall, 68% of Texans, almost 70%, more than 2/3, supported requiring athletic participation to be based on biological sex. Only 21%, so just slightly over 1 in 5, said they opposed this requirement. If we look at the partisan breakdown, this is sort of what's notable here. You know, 92% of Republicans supported this sort of athletic requirement. 73% of independents were in support of it. Only 13% were opposed. And Democrats were essentially split when we asked this question. Again, this was June 2023. 39% supported the law that would require athletic participation to be based on biological sex. 43% opposed it. And I think we've said and wrote at the time, I mean, this is one of the reasons that this has always been a challenge for the Democratic Party, because ultimately this is not an issue where the more progressive, liberal, whatever you want to call it, position hits the party well. It's an issue that really just, it's a wedge issue. I mean, we say it's a classic wedge issue for the Democratic Party.
Right.
Now, to your point about underlying attitudes, a question we've asked more frequently, and we actually did that. We actually have a survey experiment on this one too, because we're, you know, we're academics like that. We like to test things. And we asked this question, you know, basically, do you agree or disagree? You know, say yes or no, essentially. If the sex listed on an original birth certificate should be the only way to define gender. So essentially, you know, is that the construction that you hold, right, or that a respondent holds towards gender? Now, overall, about 2/3 of Texans, we asked this question multiple times, but we've asked at least 4 times since 2022. We've asked as recently as 2025 last year. In each of those surveys, at least 2/3 of Texans have said yes, that the original birth certificate should be the only way to determine, to define gender. About 1/4 of Texans say no, and then about 10% are unsure. About 90% of Republicans say yes on this consistently. About 2/3 of independents have said yes to this consistently. For Democrats, it's a little bit more complicated. It's about 1/3 of Democrats, a little more, would say, yes, that is the only way you should define gender. And then on the other side, you have about half of Democrats, just under half of Democrats, who say, no, there are obviously other ways to do this. Importantly for Texas, 60 to 70% of Hispanics across these polls have said that, yes, that is the only way to define gender. You know, there's some other items here. You know, there's another way recently. We said, you know, which statement comes closer to your own view, even if neither is exactly right, which is, you know, whether someone is a man or a woman is determined by their sex at birth, or whether someone is a man or a woman can be different from the sex they were assigned at birth. Pretty similar number. 70% of Texans say assignment at birth. That includes 65% of independents and 92% of Republicans. Democrats, again, split. 42 say sex assigned at birth. 46 say, you know, it can be different. And so, you know, that's sort of been the challenge here, you know, for Democrats in this area. And I think on the sports one in particular, as I said, when we've looked at other areas of potential restrictions, again, around sort of transgender identity, the sports one has always shown the most opposition, and also the most opposition from Democrats. But it's also reflecting these underlying attitudes, which we said all along is, you know, this is an evolving space, but it's actually kind of hit something of a static point, I think, at least in the polling we've had recently. That's my impression, at least.
Yeah, I mean, I think this, you know, the anti-trans rights sort of impulse or interest groups that were involved in this figured this out fairly quickly.
Yeah.
Right. And I think it's reflected, you know, the data is reflected in the political tactics, you know, that they have undertaken as part of, you know, in the overall strategy of trying to really limit these rights. And yet, interestingly enough, when we did the discrimination battery in the June poll, discrimination against transgender people, you know, was rated as fairly frequent overall. And again, with partisan differences, but still with reasonably high responses among Republicans.
Yeah, people,
as I recall.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And what we've seen in the last number of years is that the share of Texans who perceive transgender people as facing significant amounts of discrimination has gone up, and the share who say they are the most discriminated against group has gone up pretty consistently. And so, but I mean, I think the thing is, we would always say is, this is where, you know, if we were to go and cut all this data, right, we'd probably find, you know, pretty, I would say, you know, progressive views on gender from the people who perceive more discrimination of transgender people, you know, than otherwise. And so, I mean, there's probably a lot of alignment there. You know, I mean, so
I think that's probably,
you know, the share of Texans who both see a ton of discrimination against transgender people, but also, you know, sort of don't believe in their existence, is probably a relatively minor sell in the overall data, I think. But
right. And so there's a, you know, it makes for an interesting dynamic on this issue, I think, and makes it.
Well, and it speaks to,
obviously, as you pointed out, makes it difficult for Democrats because, you know, there's a lingering sense that there's something going on here that's not necessarily right in terms of discrimination and, you know, and protections, but it's not, you know, there's not enough consensus to keep it, you know, to drive it.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it's just one of those things where, you know, it's just an issue that Democrats just don't have control over. And I think, you know, even the Supreme Court decision in some ways, you know, reflects that, right? I mean, if we're talking about whether or not, you know, men can play in women's sports, we're not really talking about transgender existence in the way that, you know, Democrats
rights. In a capitalized rights.
No,
kind
that's
of
even
way.
Better. We're not even talking about basic transgender rights here. We're talking about something completely sort of askew of it, and that's to Republicans' advantage, and it's to Democrats' disadvantage, and remains so. And that's a challenge, I think, for the party.
Yeah, I think that's right. Okay, then that third Supreme Court case that we wanted to highlight today is the National Republican Senatorial Committee. Gives you a sense of the winner here versus Federal Election Commission. Now, in a 6-3 ruling in this case on First Amendment grounds, the court struck down federal regulations that existed up until the decision, that place limits on how much political parties may coordinate and spend in support of federal candidates. Now, we don't have a lot of polling on this specific issue, but I think because people would not have much in the way, I think, of developed attitudes on this, obviously.
Right.
But I guess we could pause for a moment, just like that. And that's one of the things that makes survey research on campaign finance law very difficult.
Yeah. That's one
because you're asking people to make judgments you're probing attitudes that probably don't exist and asking people to make judgments about things they don't know about.
And things that are complicated. I mean, look, anyone who studied, the jurisprudence of campaign finance law knows that the Supreme Court justices have had a really difficult time, squaring away, their attitudes and opinions about how the Constitution can or can't limit, political contributions and political spending. And so to ask, any normal person who didn't go to Harvard Law School and all this stuff to have some kind of developed attitude about this is a little bit crazy. I think actually what goes on top of that is the fact that there are other attitudes that are also going to be weak there. Attitudes around money are always difficult. Like, what's a lot of money? What's a little money? Right. And so that's tricky. And then in general, I think there's a stronger set of attitudes that tend to kind of overwrite any specific attitudes that people might have about this, which is just, basic feelings about whether or not the system is or isn't corrupt. And that kind of overwhelms any sort of basic, or I would say any sort of really, I'd say thoughtful consideration of these sorts of specific limits and avenues of spending.
Right. And as you say, it's complicated. Like in this case, relatively complex sets of rules about the interaction between political parties and candidate campaigns at the federal level. Mm-hmm. Pretty complicated.
Yeah.
One of the reasons why I wanted to talk about this is because the general read of the implications of this decision bears directly on the U.S. Senate race in Texas between Ken Paxton and James Tallarico, as well as the fall election. Pretty clearly, and that's been a big part of the coverage. And just to, lay that out clearly, or at least make sure the reference is clear, the idea that's out there is generally that this is better for Republicans than Democrats, and that in the Senate race right now, if you've got candidates that are perceived as having trouble making raising direct money for their campaigns, or have shown a history of not being able to do that very effectively, in this case, Ken Paxton, frankly, that this is going to weigh pretty heavily in the Republicans' favor, just to lay that out there. Mm-hmm. But I think it also speaks to a larger issue that has come up on the podcast many times in the last few years, and that's the emergence of stronger parties in the U.S. political system. And again, I think we've entertained this a few times, talking about stronger and potentially stronger, more polarized two-party system on one hand, and the conflict with Madisonian institutions. That wasn't kind of your language, but that was kind of your first response to the decision when we were chatting about it or emailing or whatever platform it was when the decision came out yesterday.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting because if you just take a step back and just think for a second here, we're in a moment where we talked about this a lot. Neither of the parties are viewed overwhelmingly favorably. In general, we keep talking about the power of negative partisanship and the extent to which, dislike of the other party is this driving feature of a lot of American and Texas politics. And yet here comes this decision, which the short-term thing is not actually, I'm not that interested in. I think that is what it is. But here's this decision that ultimately hands the parties a lot of power. If you really think about it now at the federal level, one of the things that, you just sort of have to acknowledge is that, the finance limits in terms of what parties can accept versus what individual candidates can accept are significantly bigger, right? Now, of course, they can expand than that, distribute that to a bunch of different people.
They were already bigger in the laws.
They were already bigger. And so one, the idea here being that, the parties could potentially become a vector for a lot more campaign cash, but in turn, they could then dictate the distribution of that campaign cash based on really whatever they want. And that could be, you know, fealty to the party platform. That could be fealty to the president, whoever the leader of the party is. I mean, ultimately, because the party apparatus changes out every cycle, it's kind of giving a lot of power to a changing cast of characters. I think more interestingly, at the Texas level, where there actually are almost, you know, no campaign finance restrictions, it's really interesting to think about what kind of role the state party is going to play in not only, you know, financing general elections, sure, but this is a state party, you know, who, like the Democratic Party, actually just had a pretty, you know, open discussion about how they're going to keep their legislators in line, right? How they're going to keep them aligned with the party platform. And I would say, you know, a really great way to do that is money. You know, and so,
yeah.
I mean, if the state party all of a sudden is rolling around, you know, in, you know, a handful of half, you know, $1 million contributions that they've been collecting, and they're deciding who they're going to go out and, you know, support or not based on, you know, a legislative scorecard, well, all of a sudden that becomes a lot more, you know, it becomes a real incentive, right?
Yeah. Well, and I, but I think, you know, what I'm kind of thinking about in that is that how much more, you know, how are the conduits to those races going to change and become more you know, and the amounts that are flowing from the national to the state parties, mm-hmm. how is that going to change? Because I think that's not, you know, this decision doesn't really affect the state parties as I read it.
Because it's about federal
candidates. But once you have more money going directly to the national parties, will that flow directly? And what are the implications of that for the linkages between the national and the state parties as we talk about stronger parties?
Yeah.
I mean, there's this idea out there of that, you know, in the aftermath of the campaign finance decisions that came back down in the last 30, 40 years post Watergate, and, you know, as the starting point, you know, there's an idea out there that the party, there's these ideas about the what's called the party blobs, right? Mm-hmm. That the party is really functioning in the party organizations at the national level are coexisting with all of these other aligned but not
right.
under their command and control entities. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously super PACs and all of that, but even the congressional campaign committees, the leadership PACs mm-hmm. in Congress, and how that all shifts around and then how much of that funnels down into state parties is an interesting question, I think.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. I think something else to kind of watch here is, and we'll get to this a little bit later, but, you know, to the extent, let me actually back up a second. You know, let's just do like a little bit of, I think we should do just like a little bit of political science just to sort of point out, we're talking about strong parties and that kind of stuff. And this is just to say, you know, generally the U.S. is considered to have relatively weak parties. And we talk about partisanship being really strong and negative partisanship. When we talk about the party organizations themselves, we don't necessarily think of them as being super strong because we tend to have what we think of as candidate-centered campaigns, right? The parties don't choose the slate.
Yeah.
The electorate chooses the slate of candidates. The party doesn't, you know, basically ultimately dictate the campaigns. The individual candidates dictate the campaigns. And once those candidates get to office, they can follow the party's direction or not in terms of their voting record and everything else. And that's just not really what we think of when we think of like European parties that have a lot more, in a lot of cases, control over the slate, control over the campaign, control over the party resources, and in turn, control over the actions of the elected officials once in office. And so, you know, in general, what I see here that's sort of more interesting overall is we're in a moment in which the party brands are sort of, you know, damaged and dented, right? I mean, I think on the one hand, you know, we've talked about this, it's not as bad as people say, but, you know, you've got this sort of MAGA, you know, thing going on in the Republican Party, as you said, and everybody's reacting to that, right? There's obviously a lot of activity and interest in democratic socialism and sort of left movements in the Democratic Party. And at the same, and then just at that moment, the Supreme Court has handed the national parties this kind of new lever, you know, this new way to sort of re-engage itself. And I think watching how that happens and whether, you know, the parties are effective with that or not and how they do it is going to be just really interesting to see how that plays out in this effort to, in some ways, internally, certainly to strengthen these party organizations.
Yeah, I mean, because if, you know, from the perspective of the choices being made by large donors, you know, it will be interesting to see whether large donors, I mean, I think I read a lot of the coverage of this, and I don't think there's any way to, there's probably some ways, but it's an interesting question to see if you are some of these large donors, how much are your contribution patterns going to change? You know, we have the public opinion on the parties. What are large donor opinions going to of the parties look like? And would they say, well, maybe it's just less hassle to give money to the Republican Party or the Democratic Party rather than some of these other leadership PACs or whatever? And I don't know what that's going to look like.
I guess the thing that I'm kind of waiting, I mean, I guess what I wonder about is, I mean, I understand this applies to federal elections. I just wonder how, you know, as this filters down, and this eventually there'll be cases that sort of talk about the extent to which, you know, this affects or limits what state parties can do. Because, I mean, ultimately, if it's First Amendment grounds that allow for the parties to engage in this coordinated behavior, well, those First Amendment grounds should apply to the state parties as well, because it's the First Amendment, right? I mean, I think.
Are you thinking about other states? Or are you thinking about here? Because I don't think there's much limitation on that right now here.
Well, I don't think there's much limitation. Yeah, I don't think there's much limitation on that right now here in Texas. I mean, I'm not sure. I don't believe that there is, but I think part of it is once you open the door to that expectation, right? I think the question becomes, I mean, the same Republican Party is largely funded by, you know, a handful of very large donors. And the question becomes at that point, if the role of the party organization is now to pick and choose winners and losers and to coordinate with candidates, maybe even as early as the primaries, I think that's what you're paying for. I mean, that's what you're trying to buy at this point, as opposed to go individually to all these different candidates. Why not go to the party and then say, I mean, if you think about a state house primary in Texas, I mean, it's not that expensive relative to some of the money that could be thrown around. But we'll see. I mean, this is a developing space. I mean, I think that's the thing that's interesting to me. I just see this in the context of the state.
Well, it's that dynamic that was making me wonder about how you factor in the national parties having more resources, and do they try to exert more influence over the state parties in that way?
Yeah, I mean, the challenge to the national parties is there are still contribution limits to the national parties, and so there are still limits to how much, you know, resources they can really collect. And that speaks to your point, is if I'm a large donor, how do I game that out in terms of what I'm giving and what I'm getting, yeah, the economics of that? I just think overall it's interesting that, you know, and we've talked about this before, this is one of my, you know, when reporters say, what are you watching? Mine is like, I think there's an ongoing story here about the party organizations looking to exert more power. As we point out, you know, the party organizations are kind of the least, I mean, they're not very representative groups. And so it's interesting to see party organizations who are unelected individuals who are largely pretty representative of the extreme wings of both parties trying to exert fealty tests on the elected representatives of the party who actually were, like, you know, nominated and elected by the voters. And so that's like a fight that's going to play out. And it's going to be interesting to my mind to see whether or not the elected officials at some point in one or both parties, and whether Texas or elsewhere, start to push back on the roles that the party organization has, and the party organization starts to try to turn the screws on the elected officials. Because ultimately, there are election codes. There are ways they can change the power of these state parties if they decide that they want to.
Yeah, I think it's going to be an interesting, you know, it's creating a new entrepreneurial environment that I think we'll have to see how that evolves. So speaking of that, we've, you know, this expanded, stronger party discussion kind of flags the fact that, you know, in the last podcast we were recording as the Republicans were getting together, the Democratic convention has happened in the interim between last week and this week. And now there's this talk of an upcoming Trump-driven National Republican Party midterm convention that they want to hold in Dallas in September, I think is what they're talking about. And a lot going on in the news there too. The Democratic Socialist victories in New York and then in Colorado. Now, you were, as far as the Democratic convention in the state, you were particularly interested in the prominence of the, you know, Democrat, quote-unquote, Democrats losing black support meme that emerged in the wake of the racial dynamics of the Senate primary involving Tallarico, Jasmine Crockett, and Colin Allred. Our readers will be familiar with all, or our listeners will be familiar with that. I don't think we have to rehash all of that. But it was a prominent part, I think, of the coverage going into the convention and during the convention, triggered by Jasmine Crockett's deciding not to attend the convention, different versions of why that was, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, you found that, at least in public opinion, there's not a lot of grist for this mill in terms of where Democratic voters are vis-a-vis the Senate candidates. And we should say, to be more clear, I mean, this is really centered around Tallarico, the Tallarico-Crockett dust-up, and the lack of enthusiastic support from Jasmine Crockett for the Tallarico campaign.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, one, you know, just before getting into the data, I do think, you know, there has sort of been a continued focus on the tail of Jasmine Crockett's campaign. Like, the tail isn't not the tail, like the story, but the end of it, you know, and sort of what implications it has for Democrats going forward. And there's a lot of interest in what she's going to be doing. And I think in general, you know, that's all well and good, but then that's been extended into this notion of, well, you know, if Jasmine Crockett's not ready to like support Tallarico, you know, are black voters ready to support Tallarico? And,
right.
And I sort of say, well, you know, that's a question. I'm not sure if it's the right one. So why don't we just look at the data, you know? And so one of the things we can do is we can look at our June polling, and we can look at the trial ballots, and we can look at the support for the Democratic and Republican candidates and the share who don't know among African-Americans, again, at each of the June polls. And so I look back, right? And back in 2018, which is the election we keep going back to, 49% of African-American voters said they'd be supporting Beto, 11% said they'd be supporting the Republican, 10% said other, 31% at that point weren't sure. So 49% said they supported Beto.
And the Republican there, you're being Ted Cruz.
The Republican being Ted Cruz, yeah, right. Now, jump ahead to 2026. We look at June, same time period. 67% of African-Americans say they'll be supporting James Tallarico. So that's, you know, a solid 18-point increase relative to Beto support at the same time. 13% say they'll be supporting Paxton, statistically indistinguishable from the 11% who said they'd be supporting Cruz. The big difference here is 12% say they don't know, as opposed to 31% back in 2018. And so just as a starting point, you'd say, hey, you know, Tallarico's in a much, much stronger starting position as of June than Beto was in that election that was super, super close. But, you know,
right.
We can look at something else too, which is, where was Colin Allred, African-American representative, ran for Senate in 2024 in June? 47% of African-Americans said they'd be supporting Allred in June of 2024, about the same as said they'd be supporting Beto at that time in 2018. Big difference again, 22% didn't know who they'd be supporting, probably because they didn't know who he was. And that sort of speaks to the larger piece here, which is, you know, Tallarico is a largely well-known Democrat in the state of Texas, and he's benefiting from that. He's benefiting that from that with all Democratic-leaning groups, including African-Americans. And so, you know, this is where you kind of tease this out a little bit. You know, does James Tallarico have a black voter problem? Not clearly. Does he have a problem with some black elites? Maybe. And that's kind of where the sort of story of...
Yeah, I think that's kind of the bottom line. You know, the coverage, you know, I mean, I think there are some issues that, you know, that could be explored here, but those gaps are big enough that they probably don't matter. And what I mean by that is that, you know, both Allred and Crockett are from the same geographic area of the state.
Mm-hmm.
And it may very well be that problem is maybe a little more present among somebody in that area, in that region. And it does seem like those somebodies are more likely to be elites. And going back to the party discussion, you know, maybe some party elites that, you know, felt like all that exchange kind of rubbed them the wrong way. And not, you know, and I don't have a dog in this fight. But it is interesting when you look at those numbers that, you know, one of the critiques of the Allred campaign was that he wasn't aggressive enough in getting out there.
Yeah.
And when you look at the higher level of don't knows and no opinions among black voters in 2024 compared to 2026, you know, there seems to be something to that as a critique.
Yeah.
You know, if you're looking at this in just the what is going to be the elite judgment about how a campaign is run, because voters don't sit around going, well, you know, they ran kind of a crappy campaign.
Yeah,
that's a media and elite discussion.
Yeah,
I think that is not something that voters, I'd be more likely to turn out and vote if their campaign was better. It's just not how that works. So that's an interesting dimension of that to me. But I do think, you know, it's good to flag. I mean, I think one of the things that's really good to flag here is that, you know, there's often, we have to be vigilant, and it's one of the good things, one of the virtues of having public opinion polling, to note the disjuncture between what elites are talking about or what direct stakeholders or direct participants are talking about and public opinion. And that is what the rest, you know, what most people are talking about or thinking about or what's driving their decisions.
Yeah. And I think there's an aspect of this too that I want to say is just kind of like it's becoming, I'm going to say it this way, but it's sort of routine coalition management, right? I think, you know, it's become pretty common after every election cycle, whether or not the Democrats perform as expected, they underwhelm, they overwhelm, they win, they lose, for Democratic candidates, consultants, the party writ large to sort of acknowledge the role that Black voters, and in particular, the role that Black female voters played in any sort of Democratic success. And so then the challenge, and then they usually say something, you know, we need to listen to you more, we need to do more for you, so on and so forth. Then, you know, the problem comes, and then, you know, and ultimately they do or don't, you know, and I think generally you'd say not as much as, you know, I think some groups would like, but then the challenge becomes, you know, especially in a state like Texas is, you know, African-Americans are a key part of the Democratic coalition, but they're only about, you know, 11% of the electorate. And so as much as Democrats, you know, want to keep that group happy and engaged and voting, it's also not the only group that they can focus on. And that's not to say I'm not criticizing sort of the ask, but the point is that the ask from those elites is coming with an environment in which what are Democrats going to be paying a lot of attention to? A lot of Hispanic voters going to be paying attention to a lot of like suburban women, right? And I think in some ways, you know, the Democratic elites, to be fair, are saying, hey, don't forget about us. But the challenge is they can't just say that. They have to say, hey, you've got a problem here. And that's kind of what that's what it seems to be becoming. It seems like this is a common conversation. And I think, you know, to the extent it gets played up, further, this is where the data is helpful. You can look at the data and say, well, it doesn't seem like it's a problem here, but it is more of a, you know, this is a coalitional management problem thing to me, which is pretty normal. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I was, as you were saying that, I mean, it's a long time problem in the Democratic Party.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, without going into the blow by blow, the math is complicated for Democrats.
Right.
At a certain level when they have a more, you know, ethnically and racially heterogeneous coalition than the Republicans, and with, you know, I'm not saying that, you know, there aren't any non-white Republicans, but the weights are different, and it's just less.
What?
Now, speaking of Democratic divisions, there's also, you know, just to sort of connect last week's podcast, maybe even 2 weeks, I guess it was last week, and what we're talking about today. I mean, I opened this by flagging the DSA / Mamdani supported wins in New York, the defeat of a nearly 30-year incumbent member of the House of Representatives, and the leader, you know, and a member of the Progressive Caucus, Deanna, I don't know how to say her name, DeGetty, I think, by 29-year-old labor rights activist and lawyer Malak Kiros. And I was, you know, and this really has a lot of ripples. I mean, I was asked about this contest in a live radio hit on AM Talk Radio in South Texas today. So
that's fun.
This is rippling.
Yeah, that's fun.
But, you know, very striking that, you know, this the winner in this race, you know, was born after the loser was elected to Congress. So there's a generational thing there, but also very much a Democratic socialist candidate, Kiros is. A lot going on here. I just want to, you know, connect the dots there. We don't have to really do what we did before, but, you know, we already, you know, we saw that there was a lot more support than either of us, I think, expected, or stronger approval of democratic socialism, particularly in the Democratic Party, about 60% had a favorable view, as I recall.
Yep.
And, you know, this is an ongoing dynamic, and it speaks to this. You know, we're having parties that are both, you know, getting stronger institutionally, in this case with the aid of the Supreme Court, mm-hmm. but also with some pretty powerful ideological dynamics in both parties.
Yeah, you know, I can't help but think, I mean, I'm still thinking about the analogy you made last week because, you know, about Trump and the idea that, you know, Trump is doing what he's doing, and you can kind of follow the Haberman book kind of thing if you want to sort of think more about that. And really, you know, that's leaving a wake, you know? And in that wake, both, you know, political entrepreneurs and the parties are sort of trying to figure out, you know, what remains. And what's interesting, you know, to me is to sort of see the, I don't know, the rise of this concept of democratic socialism in here. I mean, it's going to be interesting to see what happens moving forward into the election cycle, because it's clear from this data that this label in and of itself isn't poison, you know, just to put it, you know, simply, right?
It's not inside the party. Anymore.
Certainly not inside. Yeah. Well, and certainly not inside the party. And I mean, I think it's notable that, you know, Trump and others are using the word communism a lot. Right. I mean, they're trying to sort of maybe sharpen the edges a little bit.
A little bit,
you know, around
it's
it.
It's an old, you know, it's an old play. I mean,
well, but I mean, Jim, this goes back to one of those things again. And I mean, this is sort of interesting because, I mean, you know, you have a lot of, you're a little older than I am, you know, and your studies are a little bit different than mine. And so, you know, these terms are very, to you, I would say, you know, in particular, very weighty and meaningful and complicated and dynamic, you know, right. There's a lot going on here. I, you know, wonder, you know, exactly what kind of attendant ideas people attach to something like the term socialism in 2026 or democratic socialism, right? And I mean, and I think there's clearly differences, and I mean, they're notable. And obviously, you mentioned the partisan differences, but, you know, when we look at that favorability towards democratic socialism, you know, voters under the age of 44. About 38-39% have a favorable view, 32% unfavorable view. So net positive, voters 45 to 64, 25 favorable, 52 unfavorable, 65 plus, 21, 61, right? So, I mean, clearly, you know, there's an age dynamic there. I mean, I look at Hispanics, 29 favorable, 29 unfavorable. So a lot of don't know there, but otherwise split. And so, you know, I just, you know, when you look at this, this isn't sort of, even though the overall favorability numbers are 29-46, right? So it's still net negative for democratic socialism. I mean, I think, you know, our understanding of, I mean, I would tell you this, when I was thinking, reading this morning about sort of the turn to communism as the messaging ploy on this in response to these election results, you know, my thought is I wonder, I mean, I'm sure that plays well with people over 65, you know? But, you know,
Maybe a little younger than that, but yeah.
Well, I mean, hyperbolic, but you know what I mean? I'm just wondering what the actual underlying thing is. You know, we're pretty far from the Cold War for most voters under the age of, you know, 45 here, right?
No, I think that's right. I mean, I think the demographics of the two parties and the demographic, you know, look, Trump's age and background, but also that messaging speaks to a generational impression that is going to get weaker as you get younger. I think that generational impression is going to get tested.
That's my point here is I think we're going to see a greater testing of that generational message. And I sent you a little thing from, you know, I don't know, one of the Politico morning thing where Bannon is basically saying, look, these guys are organized. They've been organizing on the left. You know, the left, the elites on the left are sort of catching up to this, but like, you know, this feels like the Tea Party to them. And that's something, you know, that I think you and I are going to have to do a little digging into the data and think about how this compares to the rise of the Tea Party or not, because it is sort of an interesting insurgent thing. But ultimately, you know, even though we stopped talking about the Tea Party, the tail of the Tea Party is still impacting Republicans to this day, at least in Texas.
I mean, we've talked a bit about the, you know, the roots of the MAGA movement and MAGA, I shouldn't even say the movement. I mean, I think MAGA sentiment and Tea Party sentiment, we would find a lot of overlap.
Exactly.
If we could figure out how to do that. Now, moving, you know, to the more, you know, away from these sort of ideological labeling discussions to kind of another aspect of what's going on inside the party, like, to pay some attention to the Republicans for a minute. It's been an interesting couple of weeks with some developments in the state, on the state Republican side, that really illustrate how the internal politics of the state are being framed by this context, but also, you know, intersecting some very familiar, but I think notable tactical maneuvering. And I have two things in mind when I say this. One, Kelly Hancock announcing that he will step down as acting comptroller, for those of you that use that language, and the nearly universal expectation, including in Hancock's announcement of his resignation, that the Republican candidate for comptroller, Don Huffines, will be appointed to that office to be the new acting comptroller. Now, that may or may not happen, but that is a move for those people that follow internal Republican politics that is a very rich text, shall we say.
Yes.
given the historic friction between Huffines and Greg Abbott, who's in the position to make that appointment, and one could parse that out. And so there, I mean, we could say a lot of different things about that. And that whole situation is so complicated, given that by most accounts, Hancock was probably not the first choice for that job. A lot of maneuvering had to be done to get him in that position. And then the other thing I want to, the companion piece to that is still very much at the rumor stage, reported in, as a rumor in one of the newsletters in Quorum Report, that the Secretary of State, who has announced that she was going to step down, Jane Nelson, may in fact not step down amidst the rumors that her replacement may very well be Nate Schatzlein, from the current House member, and a member who is of a different set of party sentiment, shall we say, to use that term again, than Secretary of State Nelson. And if you're listening to this, you probably know Secretary of State Jane Nelson, longtime senator, but part of the Senate establishment in many ways, had served as chair of the Finance Committee, et cetera. And well, I'm sure that from the perspective of somebody on the left, Jane Nelson has carried enough of the water for Republican interests as Secretary of State, to not be a particularly welcome presence. On the other hand, she has been, more moderate in the way that she has handled that office than many other people that might have been in that office that have been in the office in the past have. And to some extent, one might, to some extent, maybe a little more competent, but people disagree about that. I know that we had some conversations with some consultants not long ago. But stepping back, the point is that there's a real cleavage feel to this if this story turns out to be true, because I think the broad explanation is that Representative Schatzlein as Secretary of State would be much more ideologically and much more politically driven than Jane Nelson was.
Yeah, and completely.
I think you would find very few people to disagree with that. And so, there are these other things going on the Republican side that is, the party gets more ideologically driven, and we see the parties becoming more polarized. There's now a lot of maneuvering going on, and the Nelson, the question of who is going to be overseeing the electoral process in an upcoming election in which the Senate race is expected to be very close, and Secretary of States have been under a lot of pressure from the Trump administration, from the more Trumpish wing of the party, to manage elections and administer elections in a very partisan way is really lurking here. So those two things invite different kinds of discussions, but we've talked a lot about the Democratic cleavages. This stuff really points to that there's also churn in the Republican Party blob in the state as well, right? I mean, I think that's fair to point out.
Yeah, I mean, I think the tie that binds those together in my mind, just listening to you lay it out, is, Greg Abbott, and not to, I'll just lean back into something else. Is this routine coalition management? I mean, to some extent, you've got someone in Huffines who has been at odds with Abbott, and you think about, the ability to offer this fig leaf, right? Which is to, you get to run as the acting comptroller. That's great. And also you're handing over the reins early. You're putting your stamp.
Well, it's sort of a, it's a peace offering in some ways.
Yeah.
It's a, It's a truce.
Yeah, it's a truce. I mean, I'd be shocked if Abbott's office wasn't the initiator of that kind of thing, right? And then, you know, the other side of that is, you know, the Nelson piece of this is interesting just because, you know, I've talked to a fair number of reporters about this actually, because there's sort of, you know, will she, won't she, and some other stuff that's been going on there. And it is really notable. I mean, if you just sort of take a step back and just sort of say, okay, you know, we're in a state that has nearly, you know, almost 20 million registered voters, huge state, tons of political attention on the conduct of elections, and maybe we're just going to kind of appoint somebody to run it at the last second, you know?
Yeah.
And that's the other thing too. I mean, Jay Nelson is only the second Secretary of State to be confirmed by the Senate since I think like 2016, you know?
Yeah.
And so this would be another person who would likely be, you know, who wouldn't be confirmed because this, you know, the legislature's on session, would run the election from the Secretary of State's office. So the question becomes, you know, do they even ever go up for confirmation, or is this kind of a one-off thing? And that's really where I think, you know, if you're concerned about, you know, an ideological orientation of the Secretary of State's office, this is where someone, you know, I'll say this is sort of more of an opinion thing, I guess, at this point, I'll just say it, but this is why I think sometimes people crap on incumbency and tenure in office too quickly. You know, and I'm not saying that Jay Nelson is sitting there holding the fort, you know, or whatever.
Yeah.
But right. Jay Nelson is her own person, right? She has her own career. She's been around a bit. You know, she has her own sense of what's good for the party and what's, you know, good for the state. And I think that's why she's one of the two confirmed Secretary of State that we've had in recent vintage, right? Because the senators know.
Well, and she, yeah. Well, and she was a senator.
Yeah. Right? The senators know her. And that, that absolutely helps. And the senators know her, and that helps. And that's part, but that's also part of why she was probably nominated that position too, because she could, you know, she could pass, you know, pretty when no one has. And so this is something to keep an eye on. I think this is like, this is not a little thing, you know, I mean, to your
right.
point.
And you know, and again, it may not be accurate. We'll see. This is not a confirmed account thus far. And I'm not, you know, casting aspersions, but I mean, the level of evidence for this kind of reporting is pretty low.
Well, so. I would say regardless of who the replacement is, I don't even think that's necessarily, I mean, there's a story there depending on who it is, but I actually think just that the thing itself is really notable. You know, again, given the concern that state leadership has spent, you know, wringing their hands about, you know, voter fraud, potential voter fraud, how the elections are run, you know, the idea that someone would just be kind of handpicked and put in who could be anybody, really, you know, for a 6-month job is a little, you know, it's something to keep an eye on.
Well, and I, you know, I don't know enough about the dynamics of Nelson stepping down to begin with to know how to judge how this will be greeted by the governor's office.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, one last thing, and we've gone a little long, but
I
do want to close by flagging one of the water cooler pieces from yesterday's news that is carrying over in today, and you know, partially because the national news outlets are running with it, but I think there's a justification for this, and that is the massive boost in the president and his family's personal income during his first year in office. And this is based on some disclosure forms provided by the president and his team, so it's not, you know, I mean, this is pretty, there's documentary evidence here. So the New York Times led with a story yesterday, and there's been follow-up reporting by them and by other outlets. And that story reported that the mandatory financial disclosure for the president for 2025 shows that the Trump family's holdings, particularly the president's crypto business, were extremely profitable. President had income of at least $2.2 billion for 2025, with about $1.6 billion coming from related crypto enterprises. We could have a whole podcast on that, but we won't. Now, this compares pretty favorably, if you're Donald Trump, to reported income at a baseline of $622 million with an M in 2024, right before he returned to the White House. Lots of things that you could pull out of this. You know, I think you have to bend over backwards, honestly, you know, to not see a brazen willingness to approach the presidency as a profit-making venture here. Mm-hmm. you know, one could get attacked for being anti-Trump for saying that. But I mean, you know, the president himself almost says this, that we could have made money and we didn't. And as he said, nobody cared. So we're just going for it.
Right.
And that's a, you know, I mean, that's a paraphrase, but I think it's not an unfair paraphrase.
Right.
You know, it doesn't, so I don't think it makes you a never Trumper or a communist or anything to point this out. But I think it's asking a lot to consider this as normal since it's clearly not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and yes, Hunter Biden, yada, yada, yada. But if you look at all of the things that people got in trouble for, got accused of in the last 50, 75 years, if not longer than that, in terms of presidential family members taking advantage. I mean, most of this has been limited to, you know, side hustles by family members that ultimately did not amount to much.
Yeah. Let alone billions.
Or cashing in afterwards.
Right.
Right. I mean, this kind of breaks the meter. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and it leads to a big and yet.
Yeah.
You know, in our polling of the president's personality traits, the share of Texas Republicans who consider Trump honest and trustworthy was hot, you know, hit a high point relatively recently in April of 2025, 79%, even if it dropped back to an only slightly lower 70% the last time we asked it in June of 2026, just a few months ago. And that 70% is about where it was in February of 2018. So the range and the data that we have, and I think we've done this personality test maybe five or six times, something like mm-hmm. that. You know, the range in which Republicans say that Trump is honest and trustworthy has been between 65% and 79%. So, you know, so what do we say about that? I mean, I think it does, in fact, connect to this larger discussion of the party brands and what the parties are about right now, and frankly connects with something I think that was a point we were trying to make in the last podcast, or, you know, I don't want to put you in this boat.
Okay.
But that the notion of MAGA or Making America Great Again is very personalistic in the Republican Party. And it is, you're talking about something different. You kind of glanced off this a little while ago than when you're talking about whatever people are thinking democratic socialism is right now
mm-hmm.
and how much variation there is by generation. They're two very different things.
Yeah.
Because I think it's hard to look at this data, to look at this story, Trump's attitude towards personal gain when he's in the office, and the tolerance of it among Republican voters without marveling at the personalistic nature of Trump's position vis-a-vis the Republican electorate right now.
Yeah. I mean, I was thinking about this, you know, a little bit on my walk this morning. It goes back to that whole, you know, in the wake of Trump. And part of this is the notion that, you know, the parties represent, you know, relatively static ideas and policies that, you know, you can kind of make a sensible whole of across different areas and things like that. And, you know, when you have a realignment, the idea is the axis of conflict shifts and the parties become sort of a mix of new things, right? That generally are supposed to be, supposed to be coherent, right? And the thing about, you know, sort of Trump's, the Trump yacht kind of going through all this and leaving its wake and whatever, right? Is that, you know, it's like you'd say, like, okay, so the Republican Party is a mix of what? And it's like, okay, you know, it's like anti-immigration, right? You know, sort of nativist, protectionist policies, pro-business. And then, but the key part to me is like, and whatever Trump thinks is in the national interest.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that's sort of the interesting, that's what that piece of this is what's thrown Republican elites for a loop in various instances. And it's one of the things that makes it so personalistic. And I think, you know, I was listening to you talk about it. And then, I mean, one of the things I was thinking of for a Republican voter is like, yeah, he said he was going to do this. Of course, he's being honest. Yeah, he's making money, right? I mean, you could.
This is the guy.
Yeah, this is the guy. You could line this up. Yeah. You know, the other guys would have done it if they weren't so dumb or whatever. You know, I mean, and so there are ways I think you can kind of look at that. I think the challenge for Trump is that those views are very, very strong in a minority of the electorate. And the problem is that, you know, it's kind of like, yeah, he can do it. I mean, we always talk about this. My wife and I watch a lot of reality television because I like the study of people. And, you know, one of the things when you watch reality television shows is there's always these, you know, weird environments and somebody does something and it's like, well, you're allowed to do that. And other people are allowed to react however they want. And so while it is the case that there is a core, you know, group of Republicans who feel like, if anything, you know, Trump is winning on a lot of these issues. And if he's winning himself, so be it. On the flip side of that, the number one issue in every single poll that we've conducted for the last year from June to June, so that's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 polls, has been political corruption or leadership. That's been the most important problem facing the country. The only one poll, it was number two in April because inflation and prices were higher, which again, by the way, one of Trump's lowest approval areas. So 1 in 5 Texas voters say political corruption or leadership is the most important problem facing the country. About a third or more of Democrats have said that in every single poll, which is why Democrats keep talking about political corruption and leadership. And I think, you know, yeah, this doesn't, you know, does it change people's views? No, and it doesn't change people's views on either side, right? It's not like Democrats all of a sudden think he, you know, cares even less about that, right? That none of that's changing.
It's already baked in.
It's already baked in, but part of this is, you know, this is a reinforcement of the views that exist. And I think for, you know, I'm imagining the ad that sort of says, you know, that pairs this number with the, you know, I don't think about, you know, the financial situation of Americans when dealing with, you know, the Iran war, right? Or the economy's A++. And you can see the ad says, yeah, for you, right? And that's the challenge here. You know, I mean, he can do it. He seems to be able to, and it doesn't seem like it. It's certainly outside of the historical norms, and people can react how they want. But I think, you know, on the main, I don't think a lot of people think, yeah, it's really great when people get into public service to enrich themselves.
Well, and it's, you know, it's not, and as we think about the midterm election, we think about Trump as a lame duck. It's not transferable.
No.
I mean, people are not, you know, your average voter that's not already in the tank, but even some Republicans, they may be willing to allow him that, but it's not clear that they want to allow other candidates that.
That's right. And I think,
and I think that's, yeah, that's part of what's fueling, possibly, at least in part, you know, the gap between Ken Paxton in the Senate race and all of the other Republicans on the ticket. That's why Ken Paxton is effectively tied with James Taller. It's part of why Ken Paxton is effectively tied with Tallarico, because he has some of this kind of baggage. But the other Republicans are between 5 and 7 points ahead.
Right.
And that's in our polling. Now, you know, we could have mentioned national polling came out from the national, from the New York Times a couple days ago. Very similar to what we got. Not much difference there.
Yeah.
I think actually the generic ballots were almost exactly the same margin. So I mean, it was adding extra time to raise the Trump thing, but it does seem to land right in the middle of these two discussions of how is the election unfolding and how are the parties evolving in this environment. And Trump is going to be a big part of that for the rest of the time that he is in public life, I think, or at least certainly for the rest of the time that he is in office.
Well, in a very direct way with this idea of a midterm party convention in no other place but Dallas. And I was asked about that yesterday, you know, what is that a reflection of? And to me, I think it actually ties all this together, which is, I think it's a reflection of concern about mobilizing Texas Republicans, which is something we've been talking about for a while here. And I mean, the other thing I think is worth flagging on this is that, you know, there's a fair amount of coverage and a fair amount of, you know, people in the know on both sides who felt that, you know, Trump's efforts in Texas to help Ted Cruz in that election probably did more to mobilize Democrats than Republicans. Now, whether that's true in 2026, whether that was true then, I think is an open question. But I also would say, you know, bringing Trump to Dallas, you know, provides a pretty clear backdrop for counter programming that I imagine the Democrats are going to be spending a lot of money on here.
Well, and you know, if you're a Texas Democrat or a Texas Republican, it is one of those situations where, A, I mean, I think the main question you flag, which is what I was going to drop in if you didn't, is what's the mobilization counter mobilization math? What's the balance there? And I, you know, I kind of suspect we'll see what's going on by the time the convention happens. I think the counter mobilization potential is higher, frankly, at this point.
I do. Well, look, I mean, we've talked to this before.
I don't know, but that's how it feels to me. I mean, if I was a Democrat, I'd be saying, yeah, sure, bring it on.
No, I agree. No, I mean, look, the fact is if his approval numbers overall don't improve, I mean, there's a limited set of Republicans who are going to want Trump to be showing up to their competitive districts. And I mean, that's the thing. I mean, showing up to Dallas-Fort Worth region, I mean, you know, okay. But
well, and I don't. And there's just the X factor with Trump. All that. I mean, who knows what he's going to say?
Right. Yeah, that's right.
I mean, you just have no idea how he's going to make, you know, how he might make news.
Yeah,
in this visit.
That's so. Right.
All right. With that, Josh, good idea to have a podcast today.
Couldn't help it. Just
Thanks
too much
showing
just,
up.
Just too much, you know?
Yeah, it was too much to ignore. I hear you. I have no idea what the implications are for this going forward, but we'll look at scheduling and figure it out. But thanks, Josh, for being here. Thanks to our crew in the studio here for responding to our quick scheduling request and doing a great job getting us set up. Josh is remote today. I'm in the studio. Tons of data here. I mean, we'll have to talk about whether we're going to reformat some of this for the podcast post or we'll do it in the future. But we'll put a post on the website with a player for the podcast if you want to go. But you've listened to it now. But if you want to go look at data, just go to texaspolitics.utexas.edu. You'll see a link on the front page to the blog post, and there will be data posted with that. But beyond that, have a good and safe 4th of July weekend. Especially travel safe. Stay out of the heat. Enjoy time with friends and family. And we will be back soon with another Second Reading podcast. Oh, sorry. And go USA, I suppose.
Yeah.
The Second Reading podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.